Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour education show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. The show provides practical general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get a notebook and a pen for later on in the show. And as we always do, we first start looking at some debt-related news and facts for the week. Everyone has heard that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have been bought out by the federal government. The default of up to $1.4 trillion of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac credit derivative contracts triggered by the U.S. government's takeover of the mortgage groups could result in billions of dollars of losses for insurance companies and banks who offered credit insurance in recent months. The potential losses, as well as uncertainty about exactly how the derivative contracts will be settled and unwound, are putting strains on the unregulated $62 trillion credit market for derivatives, which has been a target of regulators worried about the hidden risks it could hold for the financial system. The exact number of credit default swaps outstanding on Fannie and Freddie are not known, reflecting the private nature of the sector. But dealers and analysts estimate there could be up to $1.4 trillion in outstanding credit default swaps, a type of derivative contract that must be settled. The federal government's decision to take over Fannie and Freddie could turn out either to demonstrate that the auction system to unwind such contracts works or to set loose financial Armageddon. In a worst-case scenario, the default swaps could lead to monumental write-downs and overall financial gridlock as companies bicker over prices and unpaid obligations. And that's from Business Week. And an important point to recognize is how this takeover and buyout of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae really relates to individuals as taxpayers and everyone in the country, and how the federal government has essentially once again helped fund big business investors. Point one, pensions across the country or pension funds across the country and the globe are major stockholders of these two failed companies, and the fund's stocks, which have already severely declined in recent weeks, are now nearly worthless. Point number two, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae guaranteed half of the country's mortgages to the holder of the mortgages. The guarantees went to the original mortgage lenders, and then the mortgages were sold to new holders who also enjoy the protection of having the mortgages guaranteed if the homeowners default. So as mortgages continue to go into default, the federal government is proposing to take over and make good on those guarantees, some trillions of taxpayer dollars, at a time when the federal government is already in record-breaking deficits and debt territory. To make good on the guarantees, the U.S. must either A, raise taxes, B, incur more debt at a time when global lenders are already tightening up, or 3, print worthless money and create severe inflation. So analyzing this a little bit further, the Great Depression was caused, very simplistically here, because lending dried up and people who could still borrow were afraid to do so. So nothing got purchased or sold. Look at housing now, with properties being marketed for weeks and months without sales. Multiply that into other areas like cars, business loans, etc. Nothing sells, no profits are made, no money to pay wages, and we're all selling apples here. The total national debt of the United States of America is about $9.5 trillion. The total admitted debt of Fannie and Freddie is about $5.5 trillion. and many commentators think that Fannie Freddie debt is closer to $7 trillion. So the bottom line is that in the stroke of a weekend, the total national debt of the United States of America may increase by 70% or so. So essentially, it's very hard to see anything really good about this. If Bear Stearns was too big to fail, Fannie and Freddie provide no brainer on what the federal government is trying to do here. However, we are really moving into uncharted and very rough waters with all of this, and that means all of us individually as taxpayers. On a happier note and more positive theme, in an article by Tara Siegel Bernard from the New York Times, captioned "The Key to Wedded Bliss, Money." So if you ask married people why their marriage works, they are probably not going to say it's because they found their financial soulmate. But if they are lucky, they have. Marrying a person who shares your attitudes about money might just be the smartest financial decision you will ever make. In fact, when it comes to finances, your marriage is likely to be your most valuable asset or your largest liability. Marrying for love is a relatively recent phenomenon. For centuries, marriages were arranged affairs, aligning families for economic or political purposes, or simply pooling the resources of those scraping by. Today, while most of us marry for romantic reasons, marriage at its core is still a financial union. So much of what we want or don't want out of life boils down to dollars and cents, whether it's how hard we choose to work, how much we consume, or how much we save. For some people, it's working 80-hour weeks to finance a third home and country club membership. For others, it means cutting back on office hours to spend more time with the family. Quote, "A lot of the debates people have about money are code for how we want to live our lives," end quote, said Betsy Stevenson, assistant professor of business and public policy at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, who researches the economics of marriage and divorce. She said, "A lot of the choices we make in how we want to live our lives involve how we spend our money. Making those choices as a team is one of the most important ways to preserve your marital assets and your union," experts say. "But it's that much easier when you already share similar outlooks on money matters, or when you can, at the very least, find some middle ground." The economies achieved by pairing up are fairly obvious. However, the cost of divorce can be financially devastating, especially when children are involved. And not surprisingly, money manages to force a wide wedge between many couples. Most people think people break up over sex issues and children issues, and those are issues, but money is a huge factor in breaking up marriages, said Susan Reach Winters, a divorce attorney in Short Hills, New Jersey. Not everyone is married to a financial twin, and that's not necessarily a problem. There are several ways that you and your significant other can become more compatible and ultimately more prosperous when it comes to money. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. So now let's look at some guidelines that are compiled from successfully married people and from experts on psychology, divorce, and finance. Point one, talk and share goals. Before walking down the aisle, couples should have a talk about their financial health and goals. They should each ask the other tough questions. Do we want children? When? Who will care for them? Will they go to public or private school? What kind of life do we want? When will we retire? In my ideal plan for couples, they would have a meeting every week on their finances, said Karen Altfest, a financial planner who runs the New York firm LJ Altfest & Company with her husband Lewis. That way, they are in sync with each other's goals. Set those goals together. Jerry Ballard, 58, a former insurance executive in Houston, said that he and his wife of 36 years, Susan, also 58, managed to avoid money clashes because they share a savings philosophy. Quote, "The cardinal rule was that we don't interrupt our savings," adding that they saved between 10 and 20% of their salaries each year. As long as they did that, they were less likely to disagree about spending. Eric Gundlach, 53, of Owing Mills, Maryland, who has been married for 29 years, said he and his wife, Anne Michelle, made our expectations explicit. These included sending their son to private school and having big experiences like traveling in lieu of purchasing things. Point number two, run a home like a business. Make a budget and keep track of earnings, expenses, and debts. And structure your business as a partnership. When it comes to making big financial decisions and setting goals, do it together. When they are making the decisions together, they really have ownership of those decisions and any results of those decisions, said Mary Ann Cisco, National Wealth Advisor at J.P. Morgan's Private Wealth Management Division. Even if you have negative results, you tend to weather the storm better. Share responsibilities too. The one partner tends to control the finances. Advisors recommend rotating tasks. One person should handle investments for a certain period, while the other pays the bills. Rotate and repeat. Point number three, be supportive of careers. Having a supportive partner helps you professionally, which should trickle down to your mutual bottom line. Marrying the right person helps you succeed in your career through encouragement and support, the only kind of support that comes through a supportive, intimate relationship, said Mr. Gundlach, whose wife backed his decision to start a management consulting practice after 22 years as a human resources executive. Point number four, enjoy, but within reason. Create a cash cushion and live a lifestyle you can sustain. Many people who are working at hedge funds that went bust or financial firms like Bear Stearns are learning these lessons now. Ms. Cisco of J.P. Morgan said that because her younger clients haven't experienced a downturn, they assumed the money would keep pouring in. She said she is working with one couple in their early 30s who have two young children. Right before the husband lost his job on Wall Street, the couple had ordered $35,000 worth of drapes. They had to move to a smaller apartment in Manhattan and had to sell their vacation home. Point number five, use a mediator. Perhaps both of you have strong yet divergent opinions about how to invest. Or maybe you are a saver while your spouse prefers to hand over a big piece of earnings to Bavarian Motor Works. An independent third party, whether a financial planner or a therapist, can help you find a middle ground. Mark Schindler, a financial planner at Pivot Point Advisors in Bel Air, Texas, recently did this for a client who complained that his wife spent $1,000 a month on her wardrobe. Mr. Schindler then contacted the wife, who said her husband spent just as much on dinner with his buddies. So the husband asked Mr. Schindler to show how much they would save if they invested the $12,000 she spent each year. Mr. Schindler, careful to title the report Clothing, Dinner, or Invested, ran an analysis and found that the couple would have $1.6 million after 28 years, assuming a 9% rate of return. They are going to try and compromise, he said. Point six, maintain some independence. Pooling resources is important, but so is maintaining a degree of financial independence. Carve out some money for both partners to spend on things that make them happy. And when paring back, it's essential that each person makes sacrifices. And finally, point seven, invest in your marriage. Spend it, time and money, together. Go on dates. What that does is enliven the marital foundation, said Gary Shunk, a Chicago therapist who specializes in wealth issues. It's kind of an investment into the heart and soul of the relationship. Think of it as dollar cost averaging your marriage, where you make small investments over time. If you wait until retirement, it could be too late. Melanie Schnall-Begun, a managing director in the Citigroup family office, worked with a couple that waited too long. The husband had amassed great wealth for the family, and his wife kept a beautiful home. But once the husband retired, they found out that over the years they grew so far apart that they didn't have enough in common, she said. They had this magnificent wealth, and it was the building of this wealth that ultimately led to their divorce. So this is actually a very great point to start off the second segment of our show about taking control of your finances and creating balance. and looking at what we've done in the last show and continuing with some more points for today. And right now we are using the books of Professor Warren and her daughter. The books are All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap, and it's Professor Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi who receive the credit for the thoughts, ideas, and examples, which are primarily used in this show. And of course, you can look back at the archives at www.kruufm.com and in the archives, Life and Debt, to listen to the prior shows to give you a full picture of what we're doing here. To recap last week's show, we looked at how to build your future by paying off your debts. We want you to tackle your debts. And we looked at our formula. We had our bare necessities formula, where the bare necessities were 50% and your wants were 30%, which left over 20%. And this is all from your disposable monthly income for savings. And we discussed last week how, in fact, even though that's savings, we want to use that money, that savings money from the bank to pay off your debts and the logic for that. Because now you know where you can get the money to tackle your debt problem. And the debt problem really is the biggest issue we have to deal with once we've set up our bare necessities in balance, our must-haves in balance. And the principal reason for this is because your bills from your past actually tell about your future and influence your future, because every debt, every monthly payment, every dollar you owe is really a claim against your future, and you have to be careful about that. And we want to eradicate that claim. Debts affect what you can and, of course, what you cannot do about your future. And as Professor Warren says, paying for yesterday is perhaps the most important investment you can make in the future. Get rid of those debts and you will buy some breathing room, and it will buy you a future of freedom. And that's freedom not only financially, but because that is connected to your emotions, to your relationships, to your health, then it buys you a lot more financial freedom and other kinds of freedom, and it makes your whole life much less stressful. What we looked at was how debt, in fact, has become a way of living for Americans. It's really normal in this country, and it's just like any other standard that we have. About 80 million Americans now owe money on credit cards. And not just a little bit of money, but approximately 2 months of income, family income, on their credit cards, which is substantial. And back in the old days, grandpa's day and great-grandpa's day, you couldn't buy something unless you could pay cash. But nowadays, you have credit lines, and that gets us into deep trouble. A generation or two ago, almost no one carried any debt except for their mortgage payment or their car loan. Now we have it for everything, it seems. And if you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And as we said, in fact, just 35 years ago, the total amount of debt outstanding among all American households was 1/600th of what it is today. And that means that it's really less than half a penny on the dollar from our grandparents' generation, let's say. And we also discussed what created this problem, and it really was that the laws were changed in the 1970s. And up till then, even though people may have had credit cards, not just everybody had credit cards. They weren't for regular middle-class people. And even though they appeared a long, long time ago, the laws were very different up until the 70s. And so interest rates were regulated by law, which meant that credit card companies could make money only if everyone paid them back all the money. So in other words, the companies didn't charge a lot for interest. They needed to really screen their customers very carefully to be sure that the customers could repay. Well, that changed in the 70s as Congress and the Supreme Court quietly took the reins off the credit industry in the late 1970s, freeing the way for credit card companies to really jack up their interest rates and, of course, their fees. And it's really some of these fees that are the basis for the vast majority of the profits of these credit card companies. And also the second thing was that credit card companies back then really learned that they could make these highest profits from lending to not the wealthy people, but ordinary middle-class people, and they would make a lot more money than from the rich people. So the paradigm shifted, and credit card companies wanted to get into the wallets of every man, woman, and even child in America, because they learned that if you don't pay off your balance every month, the bank will make an enormous profit. In fact, the credit card debt has become the single most profitable line of business for big banks. Banks have found that they can get away with slamming enormous over-the-limit fees, late fees, interest rates on anyone who gets in trouble. And the second part of this was that the credit card companies really started not just jacking up their rates, but started sending offers to everyone in America, particularly people struggling just to make ends meet because of job layoffs and lost health insurance, medical bills going high, divorce rate going up. Many of these people would use these cushions of credit from the credit cards to temporarily fix their financial problems, to try to fix their financial problems. And actually, this was just the raft that they were looking for, but it turns out to be in extraordinarily dangerous waters, and a lot more drowning has taken place, as we note as bankruptcy attorneys. And that's where we left off last week in our discussion. So for this week, I want to tell a little bit of the truth about debt. First of all, debt is not good. Debt is not cool. Debt is not sophisticated. Debt is not your friend, especially when you are in trouble. And we have to get rid of any myths to the contrary. Debt is dangerous for most people, and it is a legal obligation to make payments each and every month, no matter what. So this could be very paralyzing to people when they don't, of course, have the money. And it is amazing how quickly the month goes when you have these numbers of bills that have to be paid, and you think, well, I got it this month, but in a very short time, it rolls around again to be paid. And when everything is stable and your job is good and you have a little bit of a cushion, then it all seems okay, not much of a problem. You're working hard, you're earning a decent living, you've figured all these debts out, and so you're making the payments, really no big deal. But as soon as a tough time comes, and these can be small glitches in your job, your relationship, all kinds of small things or larger things, and immediately that impact on your debt payment can make itself into a huge problem. Maybe your hours get cut at work, maybe the transmission falls out of your car, maybe you have an emergency medical situation, maybe somebody gets laid off, and frankly, your credit card company doesn't care. And of course, if you're a person who has been struggling with debts for a time, especially a long time, then you know exactly what we're talking about here. But if you're new to the debt game and you look at your credit card advertisements full of all those happy, smiling, giggling people and babies, those priceless moments in the world of debt commercials, nothing ever seems to go wrong there. Well, that's all mythical. And so you need to know, first of all, that the credit card companies have hired some of the finest psychologists and sharpest marketing wizards in the world to achieve just one goal: make people feel good about taking on debt. Credit card companies are there to make a profit, and they rake in their profits when they sell. And what they're selling is debt. They've twisted the American psychology from a few generations ago, when it was perfectly normal not to spend money that you didn't have. Well, that's no longer the case. You're supposed to spend money somehow, even though you don't have it, because somebody's out there to give it to you, to lend it to you, and you can take care of that later. And the key to the psychology here is that the credit card companies are trying to divert the customer from what happens when something goes wrong. they're peddling the debt and shifting the attention to only happy thoughts. They don't want you to have any doubts about spending money or hesitating in using the credit card. Their goal is to sneak the spending psychology into your mind, and frankly, they hope that something will go wrong in your life and then they can make the big dollars. I oftentimes speak to my clients about this, and their eyes get so wide when you say the credit card really wants you to have something go wrong in your life, because that's where they're going to make the vast majority of their profits. They make their profits when the interest rates go up and pile on, when there's late fees, when there's over-the-limit charges that balloon. They're just raking in huge profits from, unfortunately, your troubles. So, of course, the credit card company does not want you to realize that debt is a dangerous thing, and they do everything that they can to divert your attention from that fact. In effect, debt steals from your future. Debt is nothing more than yesterday's spending taken from tomorrow's income. It's a claim against your future, and it takes money from your bare necessities, from your future wants, and from your future savings. All of those things are being flushed right down the drain. Every payment on an old debt is money that disappears into yesterday. But don't really feel stupid about this, because more than 80 million people every month carry a credit card balance in America because they can't pay off their debts. They believed in the past they were safe because they were dealing with reputable companies. They believed that this was a promise of help. They believed that nothing could go wrong, but that isn't the way life turns out for most people. And it's not just credit card balances, it's personal loans, old medical bills, pawn shop loans, paycheck advances, gas card balances, back payments on regular bills, overdue child support payments, for example, loans against retirement accounts, tax refund anticipation loans, overdrafts on your checking account, department store charge cards. All of these things are debts that have to be paid off that are stealing from tomorrow. Of course, this doesn't include all of your debts, like your mortgage, your car payment, your student loans. Those aren't really steal from tomorrow kind of debt, because at the end of paying those debts, you will have built tomorrow with an asset, a home, a car, an education, and something valuable will be in your possession outright at the end of the payment of debt. These other kinds of debt generally aren't building any assets at all or creating wealth. They're just paying for the past. What you bought may be gone, but the debt will linger on. And the important principle is that until you erase that old debt, you really can't write your future very comfortably. The first step in investing in your future is to erase the past debts. And what you need to realize is that debt is outrageously, unbelievably expensive. You see the ads, no annual fee, low introductory rate. They're trying to leave the impression that debt is so cheap it's almost free, but the truth of the matter is, for the typical person, when they're buying things on a typical credit card, people land up paying for 26 years, which is at least 2.5 times the original principal that they borrowed on the card. And it shows that debt is very, very expensive because of the high interest, the late fees, the over-the-limit fees, and the more interest, it all adds up to a whole lot of money. And the low introductory rates are really, as Professor Warren says, no different than a drug dealer who gives you your first hit for free. The companies want you to get hooked, and then it'll cost you way, way too much. But wherever you are in the cycle of debt, you can take steps now that will make it stop. And next week, we will look at ways to accomplish that. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt-manageable life.